Buenos dias, world, from the San Diego Zoo Wildlife Alliance. I'm Marco Wendt.
And I'm Rick Schwartz. And we're your hosts for Season 3 of Amazing Wildlife, a show from iHeartRadio Ruby Studio and the global conservation organization behind the San Diego Zoo and the San Diego Zoo Safari Park.
Listen as we dive into the efforts here in San Diego and spotlight the heroes working worldwide to care for the species you know and love.
Listen to Amazing Wildlife on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
In an abandoned house in Poughkeepsie, New York, investigators uncover hundreds of videotapes that capture the horrifying details of a serial killer's decade of terror. This is Based on a True Crime.
I'm Chelsea, and I love true crime.
And I'm David, and I love horror movies. So today we're going to do something a little different, and this is along the lines of our October spooky Halloween-themed horror movie series, and that we were recently guests on the Victims and Villains podcast chatting about the said film that I mentioned earlier that I have a very difficult time pronouncing for one reason or another. And Victims and Villains is hosted by Josh Berkey, and in this episode today, it's going to act as a companion piece to their episode, talking about the film as well. And as you know, a lot of the time we'll talk about the true crime and the behind the scenes, and then we will walk through the film itself. And in this one, if you want to get Chelsea and I's thoughts on the film in general, we chat with Josh, get his, you know, he talks about his thoughts as well. And then he goes into a lot of the awesome and interesting and intriguing and mysterious behind the scenes of this movie. So please be sure to check out his episode. They'll be released around the same time. So, Josh, could you just take a little bit of time to talk about the goal, the sort of mission of your podcast, Victims and Villains?
So Victims and Villains is very much a unique podcast. The way that you guys kind of take true crime and films based on those true crimes and marry them together. What we do over there is we also do pop culture and suicide prevention, and we marry the two together. We use the podcast as a way to invite independent creators, other podcasts on to talk about their projects, to talk about some things going on in pop culture. But we do it mainly to let people know that if they are struggling with suicide, addiction, self-harm, or depression, that there's a better way, that hope is real, it's something that they can have. And we try to use the podcast as a way to educate people and to connect them. So education and connection are really the heart of why we do what we do.
Yeah, that's a really awesome mission. And one of the things that, you know, Chelsea and I have talked about is in the true crime realm and the horror movies, you know, we're talking about the horrific aspects of it. And I think that your podcast gives a lot of the really humanistic side of things. And we really like what you do over there on Victims and Villains. So we're proud to not only participate in a couple of your episodes, but have you on as a guest for this companion for October piece. As you mentioned, some of the topics do you cover, are there any favorite episodes so far that you have out there?
Yes. So when I get to introduce like people to our podcast, they're always like, well, what episodes would you recommend starting with? And it's we have traditional episodes that we do where we'll pick a couple topics that are relevant for that week, and we'll talk about them. But my favorite two episodes that I always like recommending to people are Ooze Hope, which is our 52nd episode, and that talks all about the importance of why we need mental health, why mental health needs to be talked about more, why people need to reach out, and we're just joined by a great slew of people for that panel, which included my wife, Ron at Webster, and his wife, Kate, who we do the Identity Network with, and Andrew Karen, who by day is a mental health specialist, and by night is a comic book writer. And also to our artists, our in-house artists, Candace Camilleri, who is just so talented that we had a great time having all of those people on. And the second episode that I highly recommend is Belmont and Bones. That is part two to our Castlevania crossover with our pod brothers over at the Retro Gamers. It's facebook.com/Retro Gamers Podcast. And that episode is all about the Castlevania anime that was, but even more important than that, it was a launching point for us to talk about eating disorders and bring awareness to those issues as well.
That's very cool. And that's a unique twist on that sort of topic. I think that, you know, I'm always impressed with how well you guys tie things together with geek culture, with popular culture. Chelsea and I are big nerds. We're geeks.
We're huge nerds. Yes.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah, we are. And, you know, we both have our things that we like. Well, if it's not horror movies for me, it's, you know, my Star Wars nerdery. Chelsea's got a list of things too. But, yeah, we have a lot of fun. So, we really like the show and, are really, really glad to team up with you on a couple of projects so far. So, yeah, thanks for the overview. I will be sure to, include links to those episodes in the show notes so that all you listeners can check those out on Josh's show. All right, diving into this film that I'm trying to avoid saying the name because I cannot pronounce it. I'm going to have Chelsea say it.
Poughkeepsie?
Exactly. Yes. Since the episode of Victims and Villains has covered, as I mentioned earlier, the notoriety of the film, along with details about the long wait for this movie on home video, we're going to chat about some true crimes that may have inspired the film, along with a discussion of the movie itself. And Chelsea is going to kick us off with some true crime to just get the conversation started.
I went back and forth on what to cover between the topic that I chose and Stockholm Syndrome, but I ended up going with the topic that I chose, which is the history of snuff films. So the term snuff films was first coined in 1971, and it was actually invented in relation to the Manson family murders. Surprisingly, I had no idea going into it that I had no idea what the origin was, but it was first written about in a book by Ed Saunders about the case, and it was called The Family, the Story of Charles Manson's Dune Buggy Attack Battalion. And in this book, he claimed that the family may have made what he at first called brutality films, but later ended up calling snuff films. And these were only rumors. There's no evidence that these films actually existed, other than the fact that the family did own three Super 8 cameras and they had stolen an NBC truck. An anonymous one-time member of the group told Ed Saunders that this movie existed that showed a female victim who had been decapitated and was lying on the beach. And it didn't show the murder happen, it just showed her body. But it turned out that this person had not actually seen the film himself. He had just heard about it from other members. So we have no clue whether this video actually exists. Snuff films, I think, as most people think of them, like snuff films being on the black market or commercially distributed in any way, they just don't exist. So films of murders do exist, but an actual genre of films as snuff films don't exist. It's basically an urban legend. In 1976, there was a movie released called Snuff, and they spread this rumor to hype it up that the movie was depicting real murders of this actress. And obviously it was not true, but it did pay off. A lot of people went and saw that film because of these rumors. A more recent one, in 1991, there was a film called Flower of Flesh and Blood, and this depicted a samurai supposedly hacking an actress to death. It was part of a film series called Guinea Pig, and this movie actually came into the possession of Charlie Sheen, who thought it was real and turned it over to the FBI. but it was not real. So there have been instances of serial killers who filmed their victims, but for these killers, it was filming the torture leading up to the murder rather than the murder itself. One pair of killers who did this was Charles Ng and Leonard Lake. They raped, tortured, and murdered 11 to 25 women in a remote cabin in the Sierra Nevada foothills. And the police ended up finding two videotapes that showed them torturing two of their victims, but again, it did not actually show the killing. Another, perhaps more well-known one, Paul Bernardo and Carla Homolka, aka the Ken and Barbie killers. Paul Bernardo actually got his start as a serial rapist. He was called the Scarborough Rapist, but he was not caught until after he married Carla Homolka, and they together committed 3 murders. They abducted, tortured, raped, and killed 3 teenage girls, and they videotaped a lot of the rape and torture. Actually, when they ended up getting caught, Carla Homolka turned on Paul Bernardo and confessed to the crimes to the police, but she made certain that no one saw the videotapes before she actually went on trial. So she ended up getting 12 years for the crimes, even though it turned out that she was much more involved than she had said. So the tapes actually show her really participating in these crimes, and this deal that was made between her and the authorities in Canada became popularly known as the deal with the devil. So she's out of prison now. You know, in terms of real snuff films, you know, although they are not marketed, there are obviously in this day and age real videos of real murders. And one of them, I'm going to mess up this pronunciation, but it's the Dnipropetrovsk Maniacs. So this was a group of 3 teenagers in Ukraine, and they ended up killing 21 people. But what they're most notorious for is this 4-minute phone video that shows them murdering 48-year-old Sergei Yatsenko with a hammer. So this video was leaked to a shock site under the name 3 Guys, 1 Hammer. And this was very recent. I forgot to write down the year, but I obviously did not watch the video, but I remember when this news hit and it was huge, which I'll get into with the last case I want to discuss. This is another very famous one. This is Luca Magnotta. So he was a Canadian killer. He murdered and dismembered Lin Jun, who was an international exchange student, and he mailed body pieces of this person to elementary schools and political offices. So it sounds twisted, but it was very calculated by him. He wanted to be famous, this guy. He desperately wanted to be famous. There's video of him applying to a bunch of these reality TV shows, videos of him interviewing for these shows that he wanted to be on. There was a show for people who underwent a bunch of plastic surgery, shows for being male models. It was like any opportunity he would take. And he also, even to tie it back, he claimed to be in a relationship with Carla Homolka online. And it was all about him seeking fame. He ended up being inspired by the success of this 3 Guys, 1 Hammer video. And that is why he planned and carried out his murder. He himself uploaded the video to bestgore.com under the name 1 Lunatic, 1 Ice Pick. So I'm not going to get into the details, but you can imagine how the crime was carried out based on that. And he fled the country after committing the murder, but he was eventually apprehended. This is my favorite part. He was eventually apprehended in Berlin while Googling himself in an internet cafe. So,
oh, the irony.
Yes, I guess someone looked over his shoulder and was like, oh, this guy is looking at pictures of himself on a website where he's wanted for this brutal killing. So yes, that is how he got caught. And that is my little mini discussion on snuff films.
Wow. I mean, that's some heavy stuff, right? I just feel, yeah, I don't want to see any of that, really.
So I always was kind of led to believe that snuff films essentially were like a more violent version of pornography, where you would essentially see a woman raped and murdered. Is that a wrong assumption?
Not necessarily raped. It is just anyone being murdered. So it's a video of someone being murdered essentially is a snuff film. But I feel like we think of it as a commercial product, and it's really not. And I think think that saying it's a more violent version of porn, it's entirely separate than porn. Porn is fine. I think there can be a sexual aspect to a snuff film, but it's really about the murder. It doesn't matter, I think, who the victim is or how it's carried out. It's just a murder on film, was my understanding.
Learn something new all the time.
All right, so keeping in line with that topic of real life snuff films, we're going to dive into a discussion of Poughkeepsie tapes, which are a series of tapes that were found by a serial murderer in New York. And, you know, one of the things we like to do on the show is discuss our first impressions of the movie. This film was initially very difficult to get a hold of. As told in the episode on victims and villains, we go into detail. Josh talks about, you know, the challenges the studio had bringing this film to market. And, you know, now that it's available via Blu-ray from Scream Factory, I've got it sitting right here on our desk as we record. You know, pretty easy to get a hold of these days. In the past, it has not. But Josh, if we could start with you, just if you wanted to give some impressions on the things that you liked.
I really enjoyed, I think one thing that this film does well is the unsettling, is like we had talked about in the, when you guys were on Victims, was the, just the unsettling nature of how the killer moves and his theatricality. It's weird and freaky and glorious all at the same time. And to me, I think that that's really, if you can create a monster without actually having to see him kill, I feel like those make the most intriguing horror films in my book.
All right, cool. So Chelsea, what do you got to say?
Well, I'm going to be very brief because I think if you want to hear my detailed response, you should check out Victims and Villains. I talked extensively about my feelings, but one thing I really liked about the movie is that it felt very original. The style of the movie, it's a mockumentary style that I have not really seen done before in a way that's not comedic. I feel like most of the time you hear mockumentary and you think of something funny, but this movie is very much not funny, but it's interesting. They follow kind of the style of a documentary interviewing FBI agents and family of the victims, interspersed with, you know, little news segments and obviously bits from the tapes themselves. So that was one thing that I did like about the movie.
All right, cool. Yeah. I think you both mentioned a couple of things that stood out to me about the film that were positive in terms of, you know, Josh, you mentioned the theatrical villain. He does feel like inspired by a lot of the horror movie villains of the past in a more realistic setting that feels a bit like a series of snuff films that said villain has made. You know, I think there's a lot to like, but also I think there are some things to dislike.
I think the major thing that I did not like about it was I did not like the killer himself. He did not feel realistic. As someone who reads a lot about true life serial killers, he felt cartoony. I want to say, so you know the saying, like a man's man, right? He felt like a serial killer's serial killer. He was like the idea that a serial killer would have of like the perfect serial killer, where he's really smart, and as we'll get into in the plot, he, you know, somehow makes his victim fall in love with him. It just felt, it felt like a fantasy that was not my fantasy. So I did not like that about it.
I think that kind of jumping off that point as well, the talking about, you know, the villain falling in love with him, obviously Stockholm Syndrome, we've seen it happen, but you kind of see that slow progression throughout the film of where she starts to where she ends. And I think one of the things that's kind of like the Cheryl Dempsey aspect of it, one of the things that I think the film does well, because you do kind of see that in the background kind of slowly starting to perk up. And then it finally is just like, boom, when you have that final interview at the end. But I think that one of the obviously this is not a perfect film, not by any means. And one of the things that I feel like the film, see, I don't know, because like I'm this time around, I feel like watching this as a reviewer, because I had actually seen this more than you guys had seen this before. I think that this film is, like David said, it's content wise, it's one of the hardest films to get through. But yeah. I don't know, like, content wise, because I feel like, to me, like, I loved the original style of this. I really dug the music of it. Like, there's not a lot about this film that I didn't like. When you do a film about, you know, a man who abducts children and rapes women and beats them into submission, it's going to be a hard topic to talk about either way.
Yes, definitely. And speaking of talking about it, we're going to walk through the film itself. So that could be challenging on its own, just because of the number of victims and as well as the horrific nature of the crimes. So there's a laundry list of victims in this film that we slowly learn about as they go through the tapes, as we talk to the investigators behind this case in particular. And I guess we should just really start off with the thing that that's just really awful. And that is 8-year-old Jennifer Gorman, who is she's the first victim that we see abducted.
Yes. So they portray this in the movie as his first victim. So although it is on tape, the way his other ones are, is we are meant to think that it is more impulsive and less planned. The killer clearly put less work into this victim, you know, whereas future victims seem to be more of the tortured and mutilated variety. And I guess many of them are dismembered and scattered about upstate New York. This was just a girl that he saw when he was driving by and decided to take her. You do see a bit of video from his perspective of going up and talking to this girl who, you know, she's pretty hesitant. She knows to not talk to strangers, but, you know, knowing that is not going to help her in this situation, because he has decided that he wants to kill her. And he does.
This scene was probably one of the hardest to watch, not having any kids of my own. But, you know, just imagine this is something that happens all the time. And just the interaction, like you said, like the hesitation, you can hear it in her voice. She's obviously very smart, very knowledgeable not to talk to weird dudes like this, especially one that, you know, talks with videotape. But yeah, it's just this one scene, Jennifer Gorman, was probably one of the most uncomfortable scenes to watch in this film, because you could tell that he's trying to force the conversation. And I'm like one of those guys that, like, when someone's trying to be like funny and they're not, it's like really uncomfortable and awkward to see weird and awkward humor played out on screen, and it's uncomfortable to me. So like, you can obviously see that, like, the dialogue between him and Jennifer Gorman was awkward and uncomfortable, and, you know, you want to see what it looks like through my perspective, and then knocks her out. Like, it's terrible.
I do want to say they play a little clip of the 911 call from her mother, where she's saying to 911 that, you know, there's blood in the yard, and 911 says, we have to wait 24 hours to file a missing persons report. That is not true for children. So if your child disappears, particularly if there is blood, basically if your child disappears at all under suspicious circumstances, that's what Amber Alert is. It is for missing children who are disappearing under, you know, circumstances where you would presume that they were abducted. And that happened. That took me out of the movie for a moment. And I yelled at David. I was like, that's not how it works. So I guess that's the danger of knowing too much about a topic.
Yeah, but it's good to know. If you don't know that, just, child goes missing, please alert the authorities right away, immediately. So in typical horror movie setup, we have the Anderson family. This is the giving a stranger a ride to the gas station, which I was taught growing up in the 80s, picking anyone up, hitchhikers, having anyone in your car, you will end up murdered. And what happens? Sure enough, this one, I don't know if I like looked away or what, but in my notes, I had that the wife, her husband's was murdered. Her his head was severed, and then she was given a forcible C-section with the head sewn inside her womb, and then she awoke to discover that this had happened. And I thought that was a dream when I was looking this up.
Oh, no, no, I saw it happen during the movie. Yeah, they don't show much of it. They kind of pan down, and you see the beginning of, like, something there, and then later on when they show her body, when they find it, you see that it's like a human head in her stomach. Yeah, it's particularly gross, I would say. Yep.
But yeah, I mean, this is, and the time that this film comes out, like, you know, you're really kind of starting to get into those torture porny-esque films of, like, you know, Hostel and Saw and just some of those other films. I think those are probably the two most this was right around the time Human Centipede was coming out, so you really had those kind of films that were shocking, to say the least. And I think a scene like this, really, especially for a second and third victim, like, this is clearly a killer that really is and this is kind of the first bit of the film where you start to see that the killer is not your average killer, because he's not a child abductor and a child killer, but he's got a mixed MO, and he's, you know, obviously he's going to do it to make it look like it's different people. And I think one of the things that, I don't know if you guys are going to touch on this or not, but there's the gas station footage where he looks right at the camera and he signs Red House, and that's where they find him. Like that, to me, like, I was just like, man, I was like, that's a guy that knows what he's doing and is taunting you that you can't catch it.
Yeah, and I think there's a point later on in the film where one of the investigators said, you know, they were possibly what was the word, that they were
a mixed killer rather than organized or disorganized killer. Is that the part? Yeah.
Yep.
Yeah, and that's one of those things that where I started to be a little bit like, they're almost kind of making him seem too smart. It's that kind of build up where it's like, he's signing Red House, but he's not just signing where he hid it. He's signing before he even abducted them. And it's like, ah, he's so smart. He planned it so far ahead. And it's like, I don't know. I can't really appreciate a movie where I'm supposed to think that kind of thing is cool, because it's still someone killing people. I don't know. I feel like this movie is not for people who read a lot about real true crimes.
This is not a movie for the weak-hearted either.
Yeah, yeah. But I have quite the stomach for this in terms of what I have sought out on my own. But it's because I read so much that it's hard to think of a serial killer being, like, cool. Besides, obviously, Hannibal Lecter, the best fictional serial killer of all time. He's cool, but not really anyone else. Just Hannibal.
Fair enough. After this, these victims, there is a plot to the film, for sure. It's not just all stream of conscious killings. And, you know, our unofficial motto is that spoilers abound in terms of the films that we talk about. So that's one of the things that we may be kind of blunt about, throwing spoilers out there. But this introduced us to a teenage Cheryl Dempsey. Her story will come full circle as we walk through the rest of the film. And it starts off in typical home invasion horror movie fashion, where the killer is in the house and he's filming it. You're seeing, of course, the tapes that he has made. You see she comes home. You see the surprise appearance by her boyfriend, Tim. And there's the dramatic tension that is created by her being home and then sort of an unexpected visitor. And of course, he murders Tim and poor Cheryl is abducted, which kind of kicks off the story, I guess. What did you guys think of that home invasion scene? Did it remind you of any other movies, or did you feel like it was just a natural part of the narrative? Did it pull you out?
This part of it really showed that, because as he's building up, you know, he's stalking her and he's, you know, watching her. And I would probably agree that, and I don't probably read as much as Chelsea on true crime, so I probably don't know as much, but I think that at the same time that this is probably something that may be common around killers and victims, you know, studying who you're going to abduct, you know, really learning the schedule and the mastermind at kind of at the same time. And there's that scene where he is actually waiting for her in the closet, in the shower, and it feels like it's got to be at least a 4 or 5 hours that pass that, you know, he's just in the closet waiting. And And, you know, we had talked about on our show with you guys about, you know, the theatricality about, you know, him always wearing the masks. Like, talking about Cheryl Dempsey now, I'm kind of curious. I don't remember there ever being a time where he is not in a mask around Cheryl Dempsey, because when he's in the waiting for it, like the very brief glimpses you get of his face, he's got that plague doctor mask. Like he has that. And you see that very briefly, that when he kind of turns and after killing Tim, you see that he has that mask on, and he's had it on the entire time. So I think that this dude is a patient guy.
Yeah, definitely. His time is on his side. I guess the duration of the killings and the fact that he waits so long at a certain point, which we'll get to, the fact that he plans and taunts the victim's mother. So he's abducted Cheryl. And then, you know, after seeing her, you know, plea on television, he goes to visit her and he films that. Her realization at the very end of that discussion that, you know, he is the abductor, I think is just... It adds a really sick and twisted touch to the proceedings.
Yeah, I agree. I think that the abduction scene, the lead up to it, I liked it. It felt very horror movie-esque. But a lot of the stuff with her was the stuff where it was pretty uncomfortable to watch. Not that it was graphic. They were pretty careful to not be super graphic, but it was disturbing. It was really disturbing.
All right, so we talk about all these transitions that the killer has had. At one point, he pretends to be a police officer, and there's one of those scenes where it's like the woman that he abducts. He slowly kind of, he taunts her and reveals that he's not a police officer, in fact. And that does not occur until she is locked in the back of her car. And this scene, I mean, it was really scary. And I felt for the victim. But the whole time I was wondering, like, how did he create this scenario so that that would happen? I mean, realizing that you're in the back of a police car, I think as the audience, I was like, well, she's going to get locked in there and she will not be able to escape. And yeah, that was kind of awful. He's just sort of shifting his persona, I guess, to fit the crime. So after he has abducted and, I mean, we're presuming to have murdered several sex workers, he is now has earned the label of the Water Street Butcher, which feels, I mean, that certainly kind of feels like a serial killer nom de plume, other than the fact that we don't hear that he has three first names, right?
Well, we don't know his name. I'm sure that he has three, though. All the good serial killers have three.
True.
Like Charles Lee Ray, right? That's a old Chucky.
Yeah. That's exactly what I was going to say.
All right. So now this part, we talk about shifting the narrative, shifting the persona. This is when the killer goes really hardcore and police officer James Foley is arrested. We see him tried. We see him convicted. We see that he is executed. And upon execution, we discover, well, I guess the killer reveals the fact that he created the scenario. He framed poor officer Foley. And that's just, wow.
I thought that was an interesting twist. Again, it's, you know, all of these scenarios are building up this killer's intelligence. And I think you're meant to be especially saddened by the fact that when this happens, I guess when he's exonerated, it's the same time as 9/11. So a lot of people don't even know that not only has the Water Street Butcher not been caught, but this person is actually innocent. So a lot of people still believe that Officer Foley is the Water Street Butcher when he's not, adding insult to injury for his family.
For sure. And I think that one thing that this film does really well in kind of perspectifying that into like that entire like narrative into really one brief sentence is when they're talking to the one guy towards the end. And, you know, he was kind of talking about how when this story broke, like if 9/11 hadn't happened, it would have been the biggest story of the century. You know, serial killer kills cop using justice system like that. And, you know, changing your MO to, again, this is obviously a killer that is studying his victims. And to me, I feel like one of the scariest portions of this film is the way that he studies his victims. And I think the way that he studied Cheryl Dempsey, he definitely studies James Foley into, you know, knowing the habits. And obviously, he knew the habits of, you know, of him to, you know, go as far as to kill the prostitutes that he killed, as well as also, you know, even have his sample of his semen in there. And I think that that set this villain up even greater. And like you say, like, this is obviously like a fantastical film. Like, you know, no killer is going to be really this smart to change, you know, MOs up like this way, because I love that there's that one scene in here where you're talking to the FBI profiler gentleman, and he's talking about, you know, we have multiple different FBI profiles, and he's kind of going through, and he's like 18 to 25 white male, 25 to 35 white male, 45 to 65 black male, and he's going through all of these profiles, you know, mixed killer, organized, and he's kind of going through every aspect and every MO and every profile that the FBI has produced on this guy is conflicting with one another.
And I love that the last one is he may be working as an FBI profiler, and then just like freeze on that guy's face. I really think that guy is the killer. What do you think, David? Yeah?
Yeah, that's what I was. Yeah, I was like really curious. It's a likelihood. I mean, they could have changed or had one of the people that they interviewed for the documentary or whatever it is that we are watching could have been one of the murderers, you know? I mean, very likely. It's a high possibility.
The gentleman was crowning that we're talking about. You never do see the butcher's hairline, so just saying that.
Yeah, totally. So there's a... on my notes, I call this scary scene with the Girl Scouts, which elevates the tension to sort of a next level, because we've started it off. This serial killer obviously has no qualms about killing children. You know, the Girl Scouts are invited into the home, and they, of course, break the rule of not talking to strangers and going into a stranger's house. And that tension is elevated. And then I feel in a way by what we discover next and the fact that Cheryl Dempsey is discovered. But it is a little bit of a relief, I feel, for the audience knowing that Cheryl has been found regardless of her condition. I mean, obviously it's apparent that she is in very poor shape, but yeah, Chelsea, what did you think about that reveal?
I did think it was interesting. It's hard to separate that reveal with what eventually happens to her that we all know having watched the movie. So it's hard to be like, yay, they found her alive. But I feel like for a split second there, I was like, oh, okay. I knew fairly early on in the movie that they were not going to find out the identity of the killer, and not just because they didn't come right out and say it in the beginning, but because of the way they were building up his legend, I felt like they could not have a conclusion where they actually catch him, which, spoiler alert, they did not. But for a split second, I guess I did think maybe Cheryl would have a happy ending. So joke's on me.
See, I think that kind of jumping back into right before the discovery scene, you talk about that scary scene with the Girl Scouts. Like, that scene is not, like, you can feel the tension between the conversation between him and the girls. But I feel like it really elevates when what you think is a table is actually when Cheryl, obviously, you know, she's looking at him. She has on the mask and she's on all fours. Like, that was just one of the creepiest scenes in the film.
A really intense point for us to, you know, start winding the story down, where, you know, the investigators describe their work to give a post-rescue interview with Cheryl herself. So they get to interview Cheryl, and this part I felt was extremely difficult to watch. I guess it was really an indicator of just how severe and awful her time with this serial killer was. Not that we weren't all thinking about how awful it was the whole time, but just thinking about how the recovery aspect of it and the fact that it wasn't a happy ending and that it was pretty apparent that she was not going to be okay.
I think it's one of those moments in the film where you obviously see the evidence of 8 years, because even right before that interview scene, she's interviewing her mother, and her mother's talking about how she kept saying when she woke up, I want to go home, I want to go home. And they finally brought her home after being in the hospital for a week, and she kept saying, I want to go home, I want to go home, because, you know, that's the kind of, you can kind of clearly see that this all of this has really damaged and broken her. And even when she's watching the interview, or even when she's doing the interview, you can see, I don't know what you want me to say, because, you know, she's been in submission for so long.
Yeah, and I think that coming at that from, again, more of the true crime fan aspect. Stockholm Syndrome is a real thing. It is people who are abducted, who are held captive against their will, and they come to sympathize with their abductors. And there are many, many, many recorded cases of this. Some are more serious than others. And you see, you know, I'm quite a bit of the psychological torture that Cheryl has gone through. 99% of the cases that I've heard about with Stockholm Syndrome, being freed from that scenario, you do kind of snap back. And you have women that are held captive for years and years and years who are, you know, tortured and raped, and they can be compliant with the person who is holding them captive. But even when they're suffering from Stockholm Syndrome, if they have a chance to escape, you know, they'll take it. You know, no one really loses that. You know, no one really forgets, you know, to the level that Cheryl did. But again, this is a movie. So, you know, it's not going to be, you know, super reminiscent of these real cases. So it's sad, and it's very sad what ultimately happens to her character, which is that she commits suicide.
Yeah, absolutely. And you know, one of the things we you know, Josh talks about a lot on victims and villains, and you know, we just wanted to point you in the right direction for resources if you are having a mental health crisis. So, you know, if you are, please call the National Suicide Hotline. It is 1-800-273-8255. Also, victimsandvillains.net has a lot of great resources. So we just want to say thank you, Josh, for providing all of those avenues for people to get help.
Yeah, thanks, man. And if you're not a talker, we provide all of our we're always a lending ear to people that are in need of it. But you guys can also text the Suicide National Suicide Lifeline as well. It's 741-741.
And with that, you know, it kind of wraps up the story of Cheryl until there's a stinger at the end, which we discover that, in fact, the serial killer has not stopped. We'll let you guys watch the movie. We'll hold back this spoiler as to what exactly happened. So you're going to have to check that out. Or actually, I think we briefly mentioned it in Josh's episode. Listen to that as well. So that is the Poughkeepsie Tapes. If I said that right, we're going to have to do a voiceover.
You did great. That was excellent. Good job.
All right. Well, hey, I got to have a joke that runs throughout the entire episode sometimes, right, guys? All right. So, yeah, go check that out. The movie itself is available on Scream Factory Blu-ray and DVD. They are not a sponsor, but we love them. A lot of our horror library is filled with films from their library. So we just wanted to say thank you so much, Josh, from Victims and Villains Podcast. Wanted to point you all in the direction to the crossover episode. I think they make a great companion piece. And Josh, how can we find you on social media?
So we are all on social media. We have Facebook and Instagram. It's at Victims and Villains, and Twitter, it's also at Victims and Villains, but there is no I's except for the last I in villain.
Very cool. Thanks so much, Josh. And we just wanted to say thanks to all of our listeners. We love you guys and wanted to remind you to, if you have not, check us out on social media as well. Instagram at Based on Your Crew, on a what? Based on a True Crime. Twitter, True Crime Based. Facebook, Based on a True Crime Podcast, and our website, where you can find all of that good stuff, basedonatruecrime.com. Email us at basedonatruecrime@gmail.com. Now, just have to remind you all, death is but a door.
And time is but a window.
We'll be back.